Good afternoon, everyone. It's the second last session of the conference, so thanks all for sticking around. One caveat here about this session is, unfortunately, due to a scheduling mishap, our in-memory OLTP sessions are slightly out of order. This one should have been a bit earlier in the overall ordering, because what I'm going to talk to you about in this session are some basic concepts for the in-memory OLTP feature as they are of most interest to database developers. In particular, going to talk about tables and indexes, when to use which type of index, and also then how to access these tables using interpreted T-SQL or the new natively compiled stored procedures. And finally, we will have a look at the new optimistic transaction semantics that come with in-memory OLTP and how they affect applications that make use of the feature. So my name is Jos de Bruin. I'm a program manager in the SQL Server Database Systems team, and I work on the in-memory OLTP feature with the main focus on query processing, programmability, and transaction semantics. So basically, I will try to convey and what I want you to take away from this session is that first off, in-memory OLTP, using in-memory OLTP, will be very familiar to any SQL Server database developer. The tools are the same, and the syntax is pretty much the same. But there are some things you do need to think about in terms of the new table and index structures and their characteristics, as well as the new transaction processing model. Now, I will just spend a brief minute on a recap of what in-memory OLTP is. So what it is a performance feature for OLTP workloads. So it does not give you any additional functionality, but it gives you performance improvements. We have seen up to 30x performance improvements. It's not guaranteed that your app will get it, but that is the potential, that is what we have seen with some customers. And when we think about in-memory OLTP, we usually talk about four architectural pillars. We'll quickly walk through them. So we have new memory optimized table and index structures. So in-memory OLTP is not about just putting your data in memory, and that makes it fast. No, we decided to rethink the architecture of relational database systems with new hardware in mind, with the assumption in mind that data is going to be in memory. So the way we store data is not in data pages and index pages that have a fixed size of 8K, and you need to walk your trees to find your rows, etc. No, our atomic unit of storage is a single row that lives in memory and is always addressable through an 8-byte pointer. And indexes exist only in memory, so indexes are not logged and they are not persisted to disk. This means also, for example, that your transaction logging will become more efficient and also the data writes will become more efficient. To improve query processing and execution of your performance-critical business logic, we introduced native compilation. So what we do is we take a T-SQL stored procedure and compile it to native code. We generate a DLL, which can execute queries and any logic much more efficiently than if you have interpreted queries. Then, in order to benefit from servers that now have many cores, many CPUs, and where you have a lot of concurrent transactions going on at the same time, we designed our data structures and algorithms to be completely latch and lock free, so they don't interfere with each other. Now, when it comes to transaction isolation, transaction consistency, you may think, well, don't you need logs to guarantee those? Because that is what SQL Server uses today. It uses locking and blocking to prevent concurrent access to the same row, to guarantee consistency. With in-memory OLTP, we have two techniques, around this, two techniques that we use to still guarantee transactional consistency and isolation while not requiring any locking or blocking. First off, we do row versioning. So if you do an update, you write a new version of the row, which means that if you are writing to a row, anyone else can still come in and read that same row. And plus, we don't block writers from touching the same row or touching the same range of data. What we do instead is if such a conflict occurs, if two writers attempt to update the same row, one of them will fail and will need to retry the transaction. So we have full transactional consistency, even higher isolation levels. We'll go into a little bit more detail later on in this presentation. And finally, the feature is fully integrated into SQL Server, meaning you can use the same management, the same development tools, same familiar T-SQL language for writing, for creating your procedures and for creating your tables and for writing your queries. Also, backup restore, always on, fully integrated. And finally, you can have in one database, you can have both the new memory optimized tables as well as traditional disk-based tables. So the size of your overall database is not limited by the size of your memory. And you can also even have joins across both the traditional disk-based and the new memory optimized tables. So that's a kind of brief overview. By the way, if you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt. If you could go to one of the mics in the corridor so that everyone can hear the questions and it will be recorded. So what I want to focus on specifically in this session is some concepts that are most relevant for database developers. First off, the new tables and indexes. How do you create these tables? How do you think about creating indexes on these tables and when to create what type of index? Then how do you access these tables most efficiently? In what scenarios do you use what access methods? We have traditional interpreted T-SQL, ad hoc batches, stored procedures, any kind of SQL modules you can use. And we also have a new natively compiled stored procedure for more efficient access. And finally, transactions. So I already hinted on our latch and lock free transaction model. And you can have these conflicts that can occur, and you need to handle them in the application. And we'll talk through, and I will show you what the implications are for, and how to deal with those. So let's get started with the tables and indexes. So what you see here on screen is a create table statement for a simple memory optimized table. Many of these parts of the syntax will look very familiar. Like the create table, you have your columns, you have your data types, familiar data types, your primary key constraint. And there are a couple of things that are new here that I want to highlight. First off, you have the switch to specify that this is, in fact, a memory-optimized table. You say, with memory-optimized equals on. That says, this is a memory-optimized table. Then we have a durability option. In this case, I specify durability equals schema and data. And this is, in fact, the default option. So default option is your table is fully durable. It is fully logged. There is a persistent copy on disk. Whenever you restart the server, the table will get rehydrated. You don't lose any data ever. Unless, of course, you have a catastrophic failure in your data center, but that's out of our control. And we also have this option to say that this is a schema-only table. And we also sometimes refer to that as a non-durable table, in which case only the schema is persisted, but any insert, update, delete operations are not logged and are not persisted on disk, which means that you take the log I/O completely out of the equation when you do operations on those tables. You may ask, can this be useful if I don't have my data durable? Well, it is not useful for all applications. It is kind of a niche feature, but there are some applications where we have seen uses when you have transient data, either you don't care about losing data. For example, if you have session state of a web application, users can just log in again if your server falls over. Or if you have, for example, an ETL process where you still have the data that was used as input to the process, if your server falls over, you can start a process again. But in general, for most applications, you want to have fully durable tables that are schema and data. Then we have a new type of index, a hash index. Now, a hash index is particularly optimized for point lookup operations. It is very efficient for point lookup operations because you only need to do a couple of hops. You compute the hash of the key you are searching for. You look in the hash table where to find the row corresponding to that key, and then you jump to that row and you have your data right away. It is much more efficient than navigating a B tree and navigating all the pages within a tree. Now, this is the most efficient index that we have, the most performance for most applications, for OLTP applications specifically, where you have a lot of point lookups. But there are some pitfalls to using it. So one thing is you always need to be very careful about that is the bucket count. You need to specify a bucket count when you create the index, and with SQL 2014, you cannot change it. So you need to have a bucket count that is high enough. We usually recommend between one and two times the number of unique index key values. Now, we realize that very often you will not yet know how many rows will be in your table. But for that, we say, well, it's usually okay to oversize. Just if you have 10 times more buckets than you have rows, that is fine. The performance of your point lookups will not suffer from that. On the other hand, if your bucket count is too low, the performance of your application will suffer, especially if you have like 10 times or if you have, let's say, 10 times as many values as you have buckets or more, then really you will see a performance degradation. Therefore, that is something you need to look out for. Some other things you need to look out for, I will touch on in a moment. So the other type of index that we support is the non-clustered index, which is pretty similar to a non-clustered index on traditional disk-based tables. It is implemented through a tree structure, and the rows are in sorted order, which means that the operations you can do using this index are typically very similar to traditional non-clustered indexes. So let's see. Yes. Now, besides tables, we also have table types. So you can create a memory-optimized table type. The syntax is very similar to creating a table and to creating a traditional table type, except, of course, you will have this option, memory-optimized equals on, to specify it as a memory-optimized table type. But once you have this table type specified, you can just declare table variables anywhere in your application. And the underlying data structures used for such table types, they are the same table structures as the same data structures as we use for memory optimized tables, which means that they live in the memory space of your user database and they don't exist in TempDB, and thus they will never generate any IO, and they will not induce any contention in TempDB because they live in your user database. Now, what happens when you execute a create table statement, or a create table type statement for that matter, is behind the scenes a number of steps going on. I tried to sketch that on this slide. So first there is a process of code generation where we generate C code based on the table definition. Right, and then we compile that to a DLL using the Visual C compiler. We use aggressive compile time optimization. We leverage the technology built into the Visual C compiler. The output of the compilation process will be a DLL. This DLL is loaded in memory and linked to the SQL Server.exe process for very efficient access to the table. Now, you may wonder, why does a table need a DLL? Well, as it turns out, if you want to interpret metadata at runtime to figure out, hey, what is, for example, the type of this column? Where in my row structure can I find this column? How do I compare two values? there's a lot of steps involved. So if we compile this down to native code, if we bake it into a DLL, the data access will become much more efficient. The question is the DLL proportional to the size of the table? No, not at all. It is somewhat proportional to the size of the metadata. So if you have a lot more columns, it will be slightly bigger. But most of the things in the DLL are concerned with functionality, like finding a particular column, decrypting a column, or comparing values. And these are kind of generic functions. So, and DLLs are usually pretty small. So then the indexes, the memory optimized indexes. So two key things I want to point out for these indexes, two key properties. One is they exist only in memory, and they are rebuilt when you restart your server. So they are not logged, not persisted on disk. The second point is that they do not contain any data rows. And also there's no notion of included columns. Instead, they contain memory pointers to the rows in the table data structure. So we just have a table data structure which consists just of a bunch of rows. And they are all addressable through memory pointers. And these indexes, they point to these rows. Now, this has some benefits. Two main benefits is that, well, you don't have duplication of data. So these indexes are going to be a lot smaller than if you would have if you would repeat the key and if you would include any columns, would be a lot bigger. But we save a lot of space by doing this. And also, this means that all indexes are covering. So you actually don't need to worry about, hey, is this index covering for my query? Do I need to do any bookmark lookups? There are no bookmark lookups because all indexes are covering. When you navigate any index, you will always get in the end to the full row. So whatever index you're scanning or seeking into, you always get the full data row, never any lookups. So this makes also querying a lot more efficient. So we have these two types of indexes. First off, we have a non-clustered index. It's kind of the easy-to-use index. So the non-clustered index, it is self-maintaining. There's no concept of fragmentation. The pages are all fully packed, so you don't have any fill factor issues, anything like that. Also, when you create it, you just specify, hey, index, non-clustered, and you're done. No need to specify any additional options. This index is particularly optimized for doing range lookups. So if you want a range of values, let's say I want to have all sales orders between 1 and 2 p.m. on January 1st, that would be like a range lookup. And also, you can do ordered scans with it, because the rows in a non-clustered index are in order, in the sort order specified with the index key. Also, because they are in sort order, you can seek. When you want to do a seek into the index, you don't need to specify all columns. You can have just the leading index key columns, like you can with non-clustered indexes for disk-based tables. Finally, indeed, they support point lookups, but hash indexes are much more efficient. So on the other hand, when we look specifically at hash indexes, you do need to specify, when you create it, there's this option you need to specify the bucket count. And if you get it wrong, especially if you get it far too low, your performance will suffer. So you need to get it right, usually between 1 and 2 times the number of index key values, but usually it's fine to make it much bigger. They are specifically optimized for point lookups, these hash indexes. Point lookups are incredibly efficient. And that is their whole purpose, I would say. Because you cannot use it for searching on a subset of the index key, so you cannot use it for the leading columns of the index key, because you always hash the entire index key. So if you're searching, if you want to search in that index, you always need to search with all the columns that are in the index key. And you cannot use it for range lookups or order scans because the rows are not in order. I will show this in a demo also. So then when you want to choose what indexes to use and how to configure them for your table, there are a number of considerations. Well, one consideration, first one is, which type of index to use? Hash, do I use hash? Do I use non-clustered? So if you are migrating an existing application that already has a bunch of clustered and non-clustered indexes, then usually the non-clustered index is the safe baseline because it supports all the operations that your non-clustered and clustered indexes already supported. So you would usually get pretty good performance out of that. And then as a second step, you can identify the indexes where you really need to do just point lookups. And maybe it is very insert heavy, and for those cases, you will want to use hash indexes. But there, you always need to keep in mind inequality seeks and order scans are not supported. Right? But also, good news is you can have both types of indexes on the same columns if you want. So if you have a column where you need to do a lot of point lookups, but once in a while you need to do a range scan or an order scan, then you can have both a hash index and non-clustered index on the same column. Then when you go for this hash index, think about the bucket count always. So as I mentioned, usually oversizing is okay if you don't know the exact number of rows that's going to be in there. Just pick a high number that you think is high enough, that's usually fine. One thing to also keep in mind is that we always round up the bucket count you specify to the next power of 2, and we do this for efficiency reasons around memory allocation. And then in case there are a lot of duplicates in the index, so if your index is not a primary key index, there may be like a lot of duplicates, then we usually recommend to use a non-clustered index instead because hash indexes are not always well-behaved in that scenario. And then also another concern for the hash indexes are picking the right index key. Because we don't support seek on a subset of the key columns, we don't support seek on the leading indexed key columns, so you want to make sure that you only include the columns that you actually need for your queries. Because you will, in your query, you will need to specify all the columns that are in the index key in order to be able to use the hash index. Okay, with that, I want to do a short demo. Yes, it's on the screen. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is, first off, I'm going to create a database. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to enable it for memory-optimized tables. And in order to do that, you need to add a memory-optimized data file group and add a container to this file group. You can add multiple containers to it. And these containers are under the cover file stream containers, so they are basically folders where we store a bunch of files. So let me go ahead and do that. Yes, that was good. Then I'm going to set my memory-optimized elevate to snapshot on. So this automatically maps under the covers read committed isolation level to snapshot, which is the lowest supported for memory optimized tables. I will come back to that later in the session. Then I'm going to connect to my database, and I will go ahead and create a simple table here. So the table I'm creating is a simple sales orders table with 3 columns, an order ID, order date, and order status. I have a non-clustered index on the date column because probably I will want to scan the rows in order, or I want to do a range lookup of dates. Point lookups are not so common for dates. And then I have a hash index for my order ID because it's an ID column, so probably point lookups. So let me go ahead and create that. And now you create this table, and we extended our system views to also give you the information about the new memory-optimized objects, so I can query sys.tables. And you can see that this is indeed a memory-optimized table. Durability is In this case, I did not specify what the durability should be, so we picked a default, which is schema and data, so the table is fully durable, and the results will and the contents will survive a server crash. Now, also, you can look in SSMS what we have in terms of objects. So I will open my database, look at my tables. I have here now my table, my cell register table. Let me look at the properties. So you can see in the table properties that this is indeed a memory optimized table and the durability is schema and data. That's one way to see it. And I can look at my indexes. I see, we can see here, I have here these two indexes, my date index and my primary key index on sales orders. I just let me pull up the properties of this primary key index. So what we can see is that this is a hash index, and the bucket count here is 2 million. Okay. Now, what I also want to show you, just for fun, is the files that we actually generate. So let me look up the database ID to actually find the folder. So I will navigate to my data folder. So usually when you use a database or manage a database, you don't need to worry about these generated files. SQL Server manages those for you. But if you're interested, you can always have a look. So let me go to the folder. So this is the folder corresponding to my database. And I have here the generated files. So we have here the table DLL, as well as a number of compilation artifacts, like the C file we used and a number of other artifacts that we keep around for supportability purposes. So you never need to delete these files, by the way. And you should never delete these files, because some of these files, we still need them for like I said, supportability purposes. And I can show you briefly contents of the C file. As you can see, this is indeed C code, with all kinds of typical things. Let me zoom in on this a little bit. One thing I want to point out here is that you have here all these funky numbers. So what we actually do is we don't have the user supplied names of the table or of the columns or of the default constraints or for the procedures of the variables or anything. We don't have that in there. We anonymize those. We change those to numbers, and that is to prevent any kind of C code injection. Okay. So let me go back to my SSMS. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to insert a couple of sample rows. I'm going to update my statistics after that, which you should always do after you load your data, because we don't support auto-update of stats in SQL 2014. So now I want to look at these two indexes that I have and what are their capabilities. So first, I want to do a point lookup with my hash index, so for on order ID. So if I query on order ID 2, sure enough, I get my data. And to verify that indeed I was doing a point lookup, I can look at the query plan. And we can see here that indeed I'm doing an index seek, so point lookup on my hash index, and we have here the seek predicates on order ID. Right? So this is working as expected. Now, I mentioned that you cannot do any range lookups with hash indexes, but let's try to do one anyway. So what I want to do here is I want to look up all the sales orders with order ID greater than 2. Let's run this. So remember, we have a hash index on order ID. Now, this runs just fine, right? Of course, we adhere to T-SQL semantics, and we will give you the query results you're looking for. But the question is, how do we obtain these results? So let's have, again, a look at the query plan. So what we can see in this case is we don't have an index seek operation, but we have an index scan operation, and and this is followed by a filter. So this means we scan the full index, so all the rows. In this case, I only have 5 rows, so it doesn't really matter. But if you have 100 million rows, it matters, right? You'd rather just scan one row than 100 million. So we have this index scan followed by a filter, and the filter predicate does the evaluation of the greater than predicate. Okay, and the second thing you cannot do with a hash index is get sort order. So let's try to do this anyway. So again, I do get my expected query results in the expected sort order. However, as we can see from the query plan, the way I obtain this is not from the index itself, but from this sort operator that I do on top of the index. So if I would have an index that supported this sort order, I would not need this very expensive sort operator. But because the hash index does not support ordered scans, in this case, I will need this sort operator. And as you can see, this is sorting by my order ID. Okay, now on the flip side, let's look at the non-clustered index that I have on date. But first off, I'm going to try to do a point lookup. And as I said, this is indeed supported for non-clustered indexes. It is by far not as efficient as a hash index. I mean, a hash index is really an order of magnitude more efficient for point lookups, but point lookups are supported with non-clustered indexes. And indeed, if we look at the query plan, we can see we have an index seek operator here, and we can see, indeed, we are seeking on this date. And now, what these non-clustered indexes are made for are the range scans. So I'm now going to do a range scan on date. So I'm going to say order date greater than December 1st, 2013. I'm going to run. I get my expected results. Look at the query plan. And what we get here is an index seek operation. So we don't have a scan followed by a filter. No, we just have an index seek operation, which means that we only scan the rows that we actually need, and this is a seek operation on an inequality predicate. Okay. And finally, I'm going to do an ordered scan. So I want to get everything in the sort order of my order date. So query works. Let's have a look at the query plan. And indeed, what we see here is we have an index scan operator and no sort operator, because we know that the rows are in the required sort order in the index. So we get what we need. So the key takeaway from here is that you need to be careful with which index you choose. Think about what the needs are for your queries and what the capabilities are of the indexes. If you really only need to do point lookups, use a hash index because that is so much more efficient. But if you need to do range lookups or ordered scans, use a non-clustered index. There's a question there. The question is, what do we recommend when you have joins in kind of primary foreign key relationship type scenario? There, it depends, again, what type of operations you would do. Now, if you have OLTP-style operations, you would use nested loops joins. So in that case, the hash index would be the more efficient one, because in a nested loops join, on the inner side, you would do point lookups of all the matching rows. But if you have a scenario where you would do merge joins, then for merge join, you need the sort order. So then a non-clustered index might be more suitable. But in a primary key, foreign key type of relationship, what you have is you have, let's say, you have a table sales order that refers to a table product, right? So you have a reference to a product. What you do is you get your sales order and you look up the product that belongs to it, right? And this type of operation, you typically use a nested loops join. For this type of operation, hash index would be the recommended way to go. So in fact, merge joins, you get those more when you have like reporting style queries where you have a lot of rows involved from both tables that you're joining together. But with OLTP style, when you do this primary foreign key relationship lookups, those are nested loop joins, limited number of rows, and hash would be the recommendation there. The question is, I don't specify what type of join a SQL Server is going to use. So should I just have both types of indexes? The answer is no. The thing is, when you have a hash index and you don't have a non-clustered index, it is more likely that SQL Server will pick a nested loops join for you. But I would say more in general, what we generally recommend is to run tests in your workload, right? Have a representative workload running and test. And we usually recommend to start with a non-clustered index, see how this performs, how this behaves, and see where you think this may be suitable. And this type of scenario we're talking about, like with sales order, product ID, hash seems to be more suitable because of the type of access pattern that you have. And then try a hash index for this case, and you will most likely see a performance improvement. Another question? The question is, as the table grows, how is the bucket count going to be managed? Well, with SQL 2014, we don't support changing the bucket count. So therefore, we recommend to pick a high enough number that is sufficient for future growth. That is a limitation that we currently have, and we know it's a limitation which we do want to address in a future release. Question is there a maximum for the bucket count? Yeah, right now the maximum is 1 billion. Okay, let's move on. So the next thing is you have your tables and your indexes. Then the question is, how am I going to access my tables? How am I going to query them and get my data out there? So we have this new natively compiled stored procedure. And this syntax here shows you the options that are required. After the required option, you have your basic T-SQL, which you just put inside the procedure. I will show you an example in a minute. So I will just walk you through what are these required options. So first, we have this option native compilation, which just specifies, hey, this is actually a natively compiled stored procedure. Then we require all these natively compiled stored procedures to be schema bound, because we don't want like a table that is referenced from the procedure to drop underneath it, because the table and procedure DLLs are tightly integrated, because we want to have the shortest possible code path to access the data from the stored procedure execution. Then a specification of the execution context is required. You need to specify under which user this procedure is going to execute. That is, again, for efficiency reasons, because we don't want to have to do permissions checks with each execution of the procedure. That we would just be wasting a lot of time, a lot of CPU, while usually if at time A you are allowed to execute the procedure, usually at time B you're also allowed to execute the procedure. So what we do is we check the permissions at create time, and then when the procedure is running, we only recheck permissions if permissions in the system change. But usually, usually they don't change very often. So, which means we don't need to check them very often. So usually we don't need to do permissions checks when we execute the procedure. Then we have something we call an atomic block. Atomic blocks are actually part of the ANSI SQL standard. They have so far, or before SQL 2014, they were not supported in SQL Server. But with 2014, we support them now for natively compiled stored procedures. and you're actually required to use one. It is a nice programming construct because what it gives you is if you don't yet have a transaction, it will start a transaction for you, and when you finish the atomic block at the end, it will commit the transaction. But if there is any failure, any exception thrown out of the atomic block, then the transaction is rolled back. But if you already have a transaction, it will create a save point, and if there is any failure, it will roll back to the beginning of the save point. Then another thing we wanted to optimize with native procs is we wanted to fix all the session settings at compile time. So all the session settings are baked into the DLL. We don't want to interpret at runtime, let's say if you say NC nulls on or off, we don't want to at runtime change the behavior. We think, well, both from a programmability point of view, that is a bad thing because when a procedure behaves in one way at time A, you want it to behave in the same way at time B. And second, for efficiency. So if we want to evaluate all these session settings at runtime, that will bring a lot of overhead, a lot of wasted CPU cycles. So we fix those at create time. There are a number of options you can specify, like isolation level, language, also date format, a number of others where we pick a default for you that you cannot change. For example, NC nulls are always on. And now when you create this procedure, what happens behind the scenes is pretty similar to what happens when you create a table. So we have this code generation, we create the DLL, link it into SQL Server. Now the additional step that we have is query optimization, because there are going to be a whole bunch of queries in the procedure, and we want to have optimal execution plans for those. So we leverage the SQL Server query optimizer to generate a query plan, which we then translate to C code and is then compiled to a DLL. So here, what you need to keep in mind is that query optimization actually happens at create time. So with traditional stored procedures, optimization happens the first time you execute the procedure. But here it happens at create time. And from then on, the plan is fixed. So because it is baked into the DLL for most efficient execution. So we have these two ways now of accessing memory optimized tables. Natively compiled stored procedures and interpreted T-SQL access, which just means a regular old ad hoc batch or a regular old stored procedure or any other kind of module. So a couple of things you want to keep in mind here. So first, with natively compiled stored procedures, you can access only memory optimized tables. You cannot access traditional B-trees or heaps or traditional disk-based tables. But they do offer the maximum performance. On the other hand, the T-SQL you can use in them is a bit limited. You can do basic select, insert, update, delete. We have like while, if, that kind of statements. You can do inner joins as well as aggregation, but a lot of other query features are not yet implemented, such as OR and union and case. And that is because we do this translation process to native code, we need to implement every query operator from scratch. And there are a lot of query operators. There's a lot of T-SQL surface area. And of course, we have limited resourcing, scoping, all these things. And we wanted to release to get the product out to you. So therefore, we do have some of these limitations. Interpreted T-SQL access, on the other hand, it does not have any of these limitations because we use the traditional query execution engine, and the access to memory optimized tables happens only at the lowest level, at the level of index scans and index seeks. All the higher level query operators like joins, unions, disjunction, all these are at a higher level. So for that, we leverage the existing query execution engine. And in those queries, you can access both disk-based and memory-optimized tables. So that is, from the functional side, all the goodness. Of course, it does mean less performance than natively compiled stored procedures because you don't have the compilation to native code. Therefore, we do recommend for your OLTP-style operations that are really performance-critical to use natively compiled stored procedures. But if you have like ad hoc queries or reporting style queries or even if you have some queries that use some features that are not available in natively compiled stored procedures, and there are no easy workarounds, such as OR, such as outer join, then you will want to use interpreted DSQL. Yes, question. The question is, can you call interpreted DSQL from native and vice versa? Vice versa, yes, from native to interpreted DSQL, no. So from interpreted DSQL, you can have a call to a natively compiled stored procedure wherever you want. You can have an execute statement, you can have an insert exec, that's no problem. But you cannot access interpreted DSQL from natively compiled stored procedures. You can only access memory optimized tables from those. Okay, so let's go to second part of the demo. So this, what I want to do here is look at table access. Is it showing? Yes, good. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to run a couple of very simple tests. First thing is I'm going to insert a million rows. So, and I'm using an interpreted DSQL batch for that. So I have here a basic insert statement, and this is inserting in the memory optimized table like I created earlier. And this is just plain old interpreted DSQL. You use exactly the same statement as with the disk-based table. And let's have a quick look at how long this took. This took 5 seconds in this case, which I would say is not too bad for a lowly laptop. This is what we got for interpreted DSQL. And we can look at the data in the table. Indeed, we have some data here. It is not in any particular order because, well, the primary key index is a hash index. Of course, as we saw before, we can always put an order by there and we can get any kind of sort order we want. And now let me go ahead and clean up the table. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to create a natively compiled stored procedure. And within this natively compiled stored procedure, I'm going to do exactly the same as I did before. So I have here, again, this while loop, which inserts a million rows. And this DSQL is exactly the same as I had before. So I'm just transplanting it in here, but I don't need a begin tran or a commit here because I have my begin atomic and I have my end here. And you will see here, these are the basic options that are required. You may think like, hey, there's a whole bunch of options that I need to write. But the reality is you can usually just copy paste them for all your native procs. Also, common misconception, actually, because we usually use this in our examples. The language here, it's not restricted to US English. You can use any language supported by SQL Server here. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to run this stored procedure, see how long this takes. So in this case, the execution took 1.3 seconds instead of 5 seconds. And it is so much faster because I'm doing now all this work inside a natively compiled stored procedure instead of going through the DSQL interpreter. And we can see, indeed, we have the exact same data in there because I was doing the same thing. Right. Okay, let me delete this data. Now, the last thing I want to show is that, indeed, these natively compiled stored procedures are not a magic go fast button. Not every time you use a native proc will you get benefit. It's usually when you are just touching one row in a procedure, then you're not really doing much, right? And then you might as well just use ad hoc DSQL. It's when you are processing multiple rows, doing a more interesting business transaction that you will want to use a stored procedure. So what I'm going to do here is I have here a new procedure that is just going to insert a single row. So it takes as parameters the values I want to insert, and then does the insert itself. So let me go ahead and create this procedure. And then I have, again, here, in this case, an ad hoc batch, which has a loop for a million times and calls this procedure 1 million times, right? And as we can see, this takes a little bit longer than if you do all this logic inside a natively compiled stored procedure. In fact, let's have a look at the execution time. It's 9 seconds in this case, which is actually even a little bit longer than when doing it ad hoc. Because in SQL Server, there's always a little bit of an overhead when you call a stored procedure, especially when you call it from T-SQL. When you call it from a client through RPC, it is usually not that much. Okay. Let's switch back to the deck. So that was that was the demo on accessing memory optimized tables. So key takeaway here is, I guess, with interpreted T-SQL, you can use pretty much the same statements as you can with the traditional disk-based tables, and it will all just work. But if you want to get the full performance benefit out of in-memory OLTP, use natively compiled stored procedures. But then again, if you don't really do a lot of work in these procedures, the benefit you will get will be limited. Okay. So let's look at transactions then, because one of the promises that in-memory OLTP has is that if you have a lot of concurrency in the system, will scale very well. In fact, we say it will, the performance of throughput will scale linearly along with your number of cores. We know we do have some limitations when you go beyond 4 sockets, but up to that, we have pretty much linear scaling. But yeah, so this linear scaling comes from the fact we don't have any latching or locking or anything like that, but there are some implications to your application. Let's step back, look at concurrency control. So when you think about concurrency control, that's all about like having multiple transactions running at the same time in the system. So you have multiple users connecting to the system, all running their transactions, all inserting their sales orders, doing their work. So when we talk about in-memory OLTP concurrency control, we think of two key concepts. So first is, it is multi-versioned. In fact, our data structures themselves, our tables, are multi-versioned. So with the in-memory data structure will contain multiple versions of the same row. So if you update a row, you will mark the old row as deleted and you will insert a new row. This benefit is that while you are updating a row, while you are writing a new row, other transactions coming in can still read the old version. And then with this multi-versioning, what we can do is we provide a snapshot isolation. In fact, or rather snapshot-based transaction isolation. All our transaction isolation, also the higher levels like serializable, they are all snapshot-based, which means that the reads are all as of the beginning of the transaction. And we use row versioning to enable this. We keep track of what is the begin time of the transaction, and we read all the versions of the rows that are valid at this begin time. Right? And again, the row versioning is part of the table data structure, so TempDB does not come into play. If you have snapshot isolation for your traditional disk-based tables, the row versions are maintained in TempDB. For memory-optimized tables, they are maintained in-line, in-memory, with the table data structure. And then the second aspect here is that it is optimistic. Now, what does optimistic mean in this case? What do we think about? Well, optimistic means that we are optimistic. We think that everything is going to succeed. Right? So when I'm going to update a row, write to a row, I'm going to be optimistic. I'm going to think nobody else is going to touch my row. Right? And indeed, if you look at some transaction, optimistic means you're going to assume this transaction is going to commit. Now, the pessimistic model on the flip side, which is typical for disk-based tables, is you're going to be pessimistic. You're going to think like, hey, this row I'm going to update, someone else will want to update it at the same time, so I'm going to take a look. Anyone else will need to wait. But it turned out that this is rare. The actual cases where you have two transactions wanting to update the same row, in most systems, they are rare. Not in all systems, but in most systems, they are rare. Right? Like, how often will you have a same user want to update update his bank account at the same time? Right? That does not happen very often. So because we take this assumption, we get away with not taking any locks, not taking any latches. We don't protect our integrity in that way. We just say we don't want any transaction to wait for any other transaction. As a general tenet, when a transaction is running with in-memory OLTP, especially if used natively compiled, it will just be running on one core. It will use 100% of that one core from beginning to end of the execution. And this also means we can avoid context switches, which are very expensive, can be thousands of CPU instructions. So this means we also don't have any blocking. Now, in the cases where actually our optimistic assumption is not valid, it proves not valid, we do check. We do check whether our assumption was valid or not. And if it turns out it was not valid, we detect the conflict when it occurs, and we fail the transaction. So if two transactions come in, they want to update the same row. So this transaction comes in first, writes to the row, then this one wants to write to the row as well. The second one will fail. It will see, hey, someone else is already trying to update it, so there's a conflict, so I'm going to fail. So the user will need to retry this transaction. And also, we do the same for repeatable reads and serializable isolation. We check at the end of the transaction whether our assumption of, let's say, repeatability of the reads, whether it holds. If it holds, we're going to commit. If it doesn't hold, we're going to roll back and throw an exception. And because everything is log-free, also, we don't have any deadlocks. Right? So in typical cases where you could have deadlocks on disk-based tables, you would have a validation failure on a memory-optimized table. I will show an example of that in the demo. So in terms of isolation levels supported for memory-optimized tables, so our basic isolation level that we support is snapshot isolation. So all your reads are consistent as of the start of the transaction. So all the operations within the transaction see the exact same state of the database. Writes are always consistent, so we always see if there are actually any write conflicts, we do get these failures. And we usually recommend, especially when migrating an existing application, to use the option memory optimized elevate to snapshot, because the default isolation level in SQL Server is recommitted, but it is not supported for memory-optimized tables. But if you set this database option to on, we automatically elevate this recommitted to snapshot isolation for the memory-optimized tables in your transaction, so that you don't need to use any hints or set any specific isolation level, which means that the T-SQL code in your app will pretty much stay the same. For repeatable read, if you read the MSDN documentation of what a repeatable read is, you have a definition in terms of the logs that we actually take to guarantee repeatability of the reads. But actually, logs, that is just an implementation mechanism. Right? What you want, if you specify a repeatable read, is that every read operation you do, if you repeat it at the end of the transaction, it will yield the same. So the rows that you read don't change in the database while your transaction is running. Right? And that's a guarantee we provide. And for serializable, what you have is, in essence, transactions are executed as if there are no concurrent transactions. In particular, what it gives you on top of repeatable read is that there are no phantom rows. So if you scan any range in your serializable transaction, let's say all sales orders between 1 and 2 p.m., with serializable, it means you have this guarantee that no rows were inserted. And again, if any of these assumptions for repeatable read or serializable are violated, the transaction will fail to commit, and you will need to retry. So I have here a simple example of a write conflict, where you have this transaction 1 and 2 running under snapshot isolation. When these transactions begin is not really important. What is important is the order in which they try to update the row. So in this case, we have transaction 2 tries to update row 1, 2, 3. We'll try to update it first. This update will succeed. And later on, the commit will succeed. And transaction 1 then comes in and tries to update the same row. It detects, oh, hey, someone else was already trying to update it. So it will fail at this point with write conflict. So in this case, always the first writer wins. So in terms of guidelines for using this this new transaction isolation model in your application. I want to call out these 4 points. So first, we recommend to use this database option I mentioned for easier migration. Then we don't have any locking hints, so you cannot specify you want an update log or an X log or anything. No, you need to declare exactly which isolation level you want, right? So if you were using an XLog before, you probably wanted to have serializable isolation, so you will specify serializable isolation in this case. Then you need to think about retry logic to handle conflicts and validation failures. Now, if your app is already robust against deadlocks, which can always happen in the system, then it will be very easy to extend, because the action that you take when there's a deadlock, retry, is the same action as you would take when there is a write conflict or a validation failure. You would retry. So you just extend the error codes that you're interested in. And finally, you will want to avoid long-running transactions. Well, long-running transactions are a bad idea in a database system in the first place. But with in-memory OLTP, it gets worse because of two things. First, when you have this long-running transaction, the old row versions cannot be removed because you have this snapshot, which is a long time in the past, so you need to keep all the row versions that are applicable. You still need to keep them in the system. And second, if you have a long transaction, there's a higher chance that you will have conflicts. So you might have done a whole lot of work for nothing if a conflict occurs after you've been running a transaction for a long time. Okay, now let's switch to a demo here. Let me first close all these query plans. We don't need them. So what I'm going to do now is I want to contrast the behavior with respect to transaction isolation with snapshot isolation for memory-optimized tables with the default read committed for disk-based tables. So let me put these side by side, because I'm going to use here two connections so that I have concurrency in the system. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm actually going to fix this script because I have this issue here. Okay. So I'm going to create first a disk-based table which has the same schema as my older memory-optimized table. And I'm going to insert a number of rows. So I'm going to insert two sales orders in the memory-optimized table and two in the disk-based table, so rows 1 and 2, which have states 1 and 2. So I'm going to insert those. And then first thing I'm going to do is a case where you will see blocking behavior with read committed semantics. So I'm going to update, in my disk-based table, I'm going to update row 1. So I'm going to begin the transaction, update row 1. So what happens behind the scenes is I update this row and I take a lock on the row so that nobody else can see it because I have not yet committed. So the row is now dirty, so I cannot allow anyone to read it. So in fact, if in my second transaction, let me connect to the database first, my second transaction, if I try to read this row 1, you will see it is now waiting. It is blocked behind the lock that my transaction 1 took on this row. So if I now commit this transaction, you will see that now the read becomes unblocked and I see the actual result. And I see the updated order status, row 2. Now, let's see what happens in the memory optimized table. So I'm going to do the same start transaction and update this row 1, set order status to 2. Succeeds. And let me try to read it in a second transaction. And in fact, this succeeds right away. Because what happens is my first transaction, it wrote a new version of the row. But the old version is still available. And the new version is marked as dirty. So I cannot read the new version. So I will still read the old version. So in this case, I'm just reading the old version of the row, which is order status 1. Right. Now, let me try to update this same row in a second transaction while the first transaction is still running. So this is a typical case of a conflict, right? You're trying to update the same row in two concurrent transactions. And in this case, and I indeed get a failure here because the row is already being modified by another transaction, so I cannot modify it with this transaction. Indeed, it says here, I attempted to update a record that has already been updated. But what we can see here, the first transaction now indeed succeeds, commit succeeds, and I can see my updated row. Okay. So that's the basic kind of write conflicts that you get. Then the second thing I want to show is a case where we use repeatable read isolation and where you get a deadlock with disk-based tables. So what I'm going to do here is my first transaction A, I'm going to read row one, which means I will take a lock on this row one. I will not allow any updates to it. So that this guarantees that repeatability of my read holds. Okay. So now my transaction B, I'm going to read row two, which means I take a lock on row two. Now, in my transaction A, I'm going to try to update row two. But I cannot do this right now because transaction B took a lock on this row two, so it doesn't allow me to update it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to wait until this lock becomes available. But now in my transaction B, I'm going to try to update row one. But transaction A already had a lock on row one. So again, I'm going to wait until transaction A releases this lock. Now this is a classical deadlock situation because you have these two transactions waiting for each other to release the locks. So what happens is that the SQL Server deadlock manager detected this deadlock and it picked one of the transactions as a victim. In this case, transaction B was picked as a victim. So it has been chosen as the deadlock victim, and the transaction was aborted, whereas my first transaction succeeded. Now, if I do the same thing with memory optimized tables, I am again going to select my row one. And instead of taking a lock on this row, I'm just going to remember that I read it. And if I want to commit, this row had better not change. Right. So, transaction B, I do the same for row two in this case. So I'm going to remember I read this row two. And then I'm going to, in my transaction A, I'm going to attempt to update row two. And this succeeds. There's no lock or anything. There's nothing preventing me from updating it. And indeed, I can, in my transaction B, I can update row one as well. This succeeds. And now I'm going to commit my transaction A. And this succeeds as well, because the row one, has in fact not been updated in the database, even though transaction B wrote a new version of this row one, but this was not yet committed, which means the change is not yet visible in the database. So, but now if I attempt to update, or attempt to rather commit my transaction B, what I want is row two to remain the same. I want row two not to be changed before I commit. So now I'm going to see whether this assumption holds, and in fact it does not hold. So the commit failed, and failed due to a validation failure, because row two has actually changed in the database, because transaction A has committed, so this new version of row two becomes visible in the database. So row two has changed, so repeatable read isolation no longer holds, which means I cannot commit. I need to roll back. Finally, I want to show you a similar example where you get a deadlock with read committed. So now I'm going to flip the updates and the selects. So I'm going to do first the update and then the select. So in this case, we do an update of row one. So we take a lock on row one. Second transaction, update on row two. So it takes a lock on row two. Then I'm going to attempt to select row two in my transaction A. And this, oops, sorry. I scrolled too far. Yes, I scrolled too far. My apologies. Let's repeat the experiment. So now I'm going to make sure I have the right transactions lined up, left and right, both using read committed on a disk-based table. Okay. So So let's see, make sure that this one is doesn't have an active transaction. No active transaction. Okay, so I'm going to update this row one. I'm going to take a look on row one. I'm going to, in B, update row two. So take a look on row two. That's fine. I'm going to select row two on the left side, transaction A. And this is going to wait for this log on row two to be freed. And again, on the right side, I'm going to try to select from row one. But the left side already took a log on it. So again, I'm going to wait. And as we saw before, one of the transactions is picked as a deadlock victim. And the other one succeeds. Now, if we use snapshot isolation instead, we can try the same thing. So update row one on the left side, update row two on the left side. And there are, again, no logs. In this case, I'm using snapshot isolation, so I'm also not keeping track of any rows. And now I can select row two and even commit from the left side. And this all succeeds because I can just read an older version of this row two. So I don't read the new version written by transaction B. I just read an older version. And similarly, on the right side, I can select row one and commit as well. And this succeeds. So an example where with read committed isolation on disk-based tables, with locking, you get the deadlocks. That's using snapshot with memory-optimized tables. It succeeds. Okay. So let's go back to the slides. So I think the key takeaway for here is that, well, in many cases, many parts of your application, the change from read committed to snapshot will not really affect you all that much. But there are cases where you will have effects. So you will have the possibility to get these write conflicts, especially, and you need to handle those in your application. And also, you have the snapshot isolation, so you will always read as of the beginning of the transaction. For most transactions, especially short-running transactions, it does not really matter going from read committed to snapshot, but there could be cases in a transaction where you actually rely on always reading like an up-to-date version of the database, which is not the case with snapshot. That's something you may want to keep in mind. So now the final thing I kind of want to point out is that we do have some limitations on in-memory OLTP in SQL Server 2014. I mentioned some already in the presentation. So for our memory optimized tables, the key limitations are that we don't support triggers. There are a couple of data types we don't support, most notably lob types. So nvarchar max and var binary max are not supported. We don't support foreign key or check constraints. We do support primary key and default constraints. And we don't support schema changes, so no alter table, no add or remove column, also no add remove index. And finally, for natively compiled stored procedures, we do support the basic procedural logic like if and while. And for queries, we support select, insert, update, delete with inner joins and also with aggregates, but we don't support outer join, distinct, or. And in terms of built-in functions support in natively compiled stored procedures, we have kind of the core of the math, datetime, and string functions. But that's it. Key thing here to keep in mind is that we did need to re-implement every query operator that we support and also every built-in function for natively compiled stored procedures. Now, I will say this list of limitations, this list is also not exhaustive. This is just a couple of things I wanted to call out. The list seems pretty long. And we are aware of that, but we did want to ship and get the product out and get feedback. And we are working on a V2, and we are still investing in removing a lot of these limitations. Yes. The question is spatial support. No, we don't support spatial. No CLR at this point. Yes. The question is V2 going to be service pack or new release? It's going to be a new release. The question is, with the current feature set, what is the business use case where this could be useful? There are a lot of cases. These limitations, these are very much kind of tied to how you actually did model your application and how you implemented the business logic. So if you have an existing application, you may use a lot of these features, and this could block you from actually migrating your application. But typically, if you would write a new application, then you would not use the features that are not available, right? You find ways to not use them. So I would say these limitations, they're not tied to specific business use cases. But in general, if you don't use a lot of these, then it will be easier to migrate. And where we have seen successful adoption is like session state management, foreign currency trading. We have seen like in batch update ETL type scenarios, and also kind of shock absorber scenarios where you have a large influx of data coming into the database, which are hard to process for a disk-based table. You use the memory optimized table to absorb these shocks and absorb spikes in the workload and offload those in batches to disk-based tables. Those are kind of scenarios where we have customers currently using the product in production. But there are many more use cases that I could think of. Okay, let me just quickly wrap up because I have a red blinking light here. I don't want to go through the recap. Just if you just take away two things here is, well, if you know SQL Server, you know in-memory OLTP because you have the same tooling, the same T-SQL syntax. But you do need to mind the new table and index data structures, especially think about indexes when you are designing your application, migrating your application, and think about the implications of new transaction model, especially the need to handle retries on write conflicts. So we have here links to related sessions that have already taken place, but you can review them later on, or if you're watching this online, you can look at any of these sessions. I have a bunch of links here. You can download the deck, look at any of these references, and what is all this? Okay, so resources, and please evaluate this session. And I will be available for questions offline after this session. Thanks very much.